we'd like to welcome everybody here again this evening. Despite our very small number, we do have some folks that are visiting with us. We're glad to have you with us and hope you get to be back with us again soon and that you'll feel profited by our time together in Bible study this evening. We have on our Sunday nights been studying through a sort of a survey of the Old Testament based more or less on a class I teach over at Florida College, which I'm not teaching right now, and therefore I don't have to worry about this overlapping with something people are having to sit through in the classes there. And so we have been following through and really have come probably over two-thirds of the way through the Old Testament thus far. In fact, I might take just a moment to kind of summarize where we are, and particularly the point to which we have come in our study tonight. We can go back at least all the way back to Abraham. And I find it very useful to think in terms of a timeline. Abraham lived about 2,000 years before Christ. In many ways, the story of the Old Testament, the story of the children of Israel, the story of the plan of salvation actually begins with the promise that God made to Abraham back in the book of Genesis and 12th chapter. And from that point on, we follow the story of those descendants of Abraham to whom God made the promise that through his descendants, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. And we come to the days of his grandson, Jacob. In his days, the children of Israel end up going down into the land of Egypt. And, of course, they are in the land of Egypt for about 400 years, where they become slaves in the land of Egypt. And then God delivers them out of that Egyptian bondage. That would have been probably about 1,440 years before Christ. And, of course, the key character there was Moses. God raised up Moses, and through him, God brought the plagues on the land of Egypt. Through him, the children of Israel observed the Passover and were led out of the land of Egypt and ultimately through the wilderness. A period of 40 years in the wilderness until finally they came to the edge of the promised land. And in the days of Joshua, which we're studying about actually in our Wednesday night class right now, in the days of Joshua, they came into the promised land. And there they lived under the judges that God appointed over them for a period of about 350 years until finally they had a kingdom. They asked for a king, and God gave them a king. The first king that he gave them turned out to be a bitter disappointment because they'd asked for a king like the nations round about them, and God gave them just that, a powerful king that eventually became very corrupt. But we had the reigns of Saul, and then David, the man after God's own heart, and then Solomon. And those were, as we noted, in many ways the glory days for the children of Israel. Especially during the days of Solomon, they really controlled all of the territory that God had promised to them. They were not defeated by their enemies. They were very prosperous. It was a time simply of peace and prosperity for the people of God. It was in that day and that time that God had them build the temple as his dwelling place there among them. But after those glory days, things pretty quickly went sour. Solomon died about 930 years before Christ. And when he died, the kingdom split apart. We refer to that period of Saul, David, and Solomon as the time of the united monarchy, because the whole nation was together as a single kingdom. But Solomon had become unfaithful during the latter years of his life, and God had said he was going to tear the kingdom away from him. Not entirely, but largely, the kingdom was going to be taken away from him. And so they were split. They were split into a northern kingdom that bore the name Israel, continued to carry that name, and that consisted of 10 of the 12 tribes. So 10/12 of the nation, 10 of the 12 tribes, constituted that northern kingdom of Israel. In the south, the descendants of David and Solomon continued to reign down there, and the main tribe down there was Judah. There were really only two-tenths of the nation down there, two out of 12. two of the 12 tribes were down there, and that southern kingdom was known as Judah. And we've been studying especially about what happened to the northern kingdom of Israel. And, of course, they simply turned away from God. That was exemplified perhaps more than anything else in the fact that instead of going back to the temple to worship, they built golden calves and set them up at the site of Dan and Bethel. And, you know, it wasn't like they didn't know about the golden calf down at Mount Sinai. It was really, I think, matter of fact, when Jeroboam set up those golden calves up here in the north, he said the very same thing that Aaron had said down at Mount Sinai years before. Behold your gods who brought you up out of Egypt. They were consciously turning away and turning back to something that had been rejected already. It was a very wicked kingdom in God's eyes up there in the north that only fell further and further away. We looked especially at the king by the name of Ahab who lived and at that time and who even turned to the worship of Baal. And we noted the wickedness of that northern kingdom. Now, what we have come to tonight, and we're going to finish out, there's really not a lot more of this story here as we follow our timeline, because what's going to happen, what we're going to talk about tonight, is how this northern kingdom of Israel came to its end in the year 722 B.C. That is exactly what the prophet Amos had foretold. During the days of King Jeroboam, the northern kingdom had become very, very wicked, and God sent his prophet Amos, that we'd also studied about. That was actually our last lesson, where Amos had come to this northern kingdom of Israel in the mid-700s, probably around 750, only about 30 years, about a generation before they finally fell. And he warned them about their sins and what was going to happen to them, that God was going to judge them, God was going to punish them for their sins. And tonight, we're going to talk just a little bit about the circumstances of that last generation. What happened? Now, the prophet Hosea lived during that period, and it was a continued period of wickedness, but it was also a period of, really, you just have to say, political chaos. The prophet Hosea, speaking on God's behalf, said, "They have set up kings, but not by me." And what happened, just I guess the easiest way to illustrate what happened during this last little segment right here can best be illustrated just by telling you who the kings were and what happened to them. When Jeroboam died, he was succeeded by his son, Zechariah. And of course, there are lots of Zechariahs in the Bible, right? At the moment, it doesn't matter if you sort out exactly which one this is. This is the one that lived there at that time. And he reigned for 6 months. And then he was assassinated. And he was assassinated by a fellow named Shallum. Shallum made Zechariah look like a long, enduring fellow. Shallum reigned for 1 month. And then he was assassinated. And he was succeeded by the fellow that assassinated him named Menachem. You look at it, we might say Menahem, they would say Menachem. But Menahem, now he really did last a long time. He reigned for about 10 years. He apparently wasn't assassinated, but he passed the kingdom on to his son, Pekahiah. And Pekahiah reigned for just 2 years, and he was assassinated. And he was assassinated by a fellow who really had the same name, but was usually identified by the short form of it, Pekah. And we're told that Pekah reigned for 20 years. Well, we have to kind of put an asterisk beside that, like they do in the record books. Apparently, he'd been claiming to be king the whole time. Even when Zechariah was reigning, and Shallum, and Menachem, and these other fellows, Pekah apparently had set himself up as king somewhere else. And that there were even two or three different people claiming to be king at the same time. But he reigned for a period of time, and he was assassinated. And then he was succeeded by Hoshea, who was the last of these kings. And he reigned for a period of 9 years, or 11 years. 9 years if you count from the time that he began to reign until the time he was taken prisoner. Or 11 years, if you count to the time that his kingdom finally was destroyed. But he was taken to prison by the Assyrians, the nation that God had raised up to bring this judgment. And if you look, that was their kings. And they were changing kings as fast as they could kill them. Constant turmoil. And, of course, the prophets had warned of this very thing. So say, Hosea had said, on God's behalf, they have set up kings, but not by me. Elsewhere he had said, I gave him a king in my anger, and I took him away in my wrath. So it's a time of just total, his nation that was falling apart. And in many ways, it was a nation that fell apart from within as much as it was a nation that was defeated by the Assyrians. But eventually, the Assyrians, one of the superpowers of the ancient world, did arrive, and they destroyed this fragile little kingdom, and they took its king, Hoshea, away as prisoner, presumably executed him. We don't actually learn the circumstances of his death, but took him away as prisoner and took the population away captive, and that was the end of the northern kingdom of Israel. Now I want you to turn to 2 Kings, chapter 17, and we read briefly there the description of what happened and why it happened. In 2 Kings, starting in the 17th chapter, 2 Kings chapter 17, and I'm going to pick up actually in the fifth verse right here. 2 Kings chapter 17 and verse 5. It says, then the king of Assyria was, as we said, one of the superpowers, like the United States or the Soviet Union in our century. It was Egypt and Assyria. They were the superpowers in this day and time. And so the king of Assyria, we are told, invaded the whole land and went up to Samaria, that was the capital of that northern kingdom of Israel, and besieged it 3 years. In the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria and carried Israel away into exile to Assyria and settled them in these other countries, in Hala, and Habor, and the river Gozan, and the city of the Medes. And that's just the bare facts that the Assyrians came up and captured. But here's what it means. Verse 7 says, now this came about because the sons of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who brought them up from the land of Egypt, from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Now that's going back a long ways. That's going back to the days of Moses, about 800 years earlier. And he said, but because they had continued to rebel against God during all that period of time, God eventually had all he could take. Verse 8 says, they walked in the customs of the nations whom the Lord had driven out before the sons of Israel, and the custom of the kings of Israel, which they had introduced. And the sons of Israel did secretly things which were not right against the Lord their God. They built for themselves high places in all their towns, from watchtower to fortified city. In other words, from the littlest village where they just had a watchtower to the big fortified city. They set up these high places, which were places of pagan worship. And in verse 10, says they set for themselves sacred pillars and a shirim on every high hill and under every green tree. And these were idolatrous items here. The Asherim were actually some type, apparently, of image or representation of the Canaanite goddess Asherah. It says, and there they burned incense on all the high places, as the nations did which God had carried away to exile before them. And they did evil things, provoking the Lord. In other words, they did exactly the same things the Canaanites had done, whom God had driven out to give this land to the Israelites many years before. And they did this, even though the Lord had warned them clearly in verse 12. They served idols, concerning which the Lord had said to them, you shall not do this thing. Yet the Lord warned Israel and Judah through all the prophets, men like Amos and Hosea and Isaiah, that we'll be looking at in a few moments, saying, turn from your evil ways and keep my commandments, my statutes according to all the law which I commanded your fathers, and which I sent you through my servants, the prophets. However, they did not listen, but stiffened their neck like their fathers, who did not believe in the Lord their God. Goes on to say they rejected his laws in verse 16, or verse 15. They forsook his commandments in verse 16. They, in verse 17, made their sons and daughters pass through the fire, actually offered them as child sacrifices. Verse 18, so the Lord was very angry with Israel. the northern tribes there, and removed them from his sight. None was left except the tribe of Judah, and that, of course, down in the south. And so the northern kingdom was simply destroyed. I usually say to my students, there are three causes for this fall. One was simply the political back of Assyria. God had raised up Assyria to execute his judgment. But God had done that because, spiritually speaking, they were wicked. The spiritual cause was the fact that they had rejected God. They rejected God, and finally God rejected them. But there was also simply the internal cause. Their own corruption had made them so weak that they were vulnerable to fall before any power, and especially before a superpower like Assyria. And so that brings the northern kingdom of Israel to its end. But that's not really the main point. I'm trying to do a sort of a survey of the Old Testament, so it brings the northern kingdom to its end. What I really want us to focus on by way of a lesson tonight is something that was going on down in the south during this period, down in the southern kingdom. And particularly, at the time all of this was happening, the fellow who was king down in the south was a fellow by the name of Ahaz. And I'll tell you, the political situation that he found himself in, while this fellow right here, Pekah, was on the throne, the next to the last king that they had up here, right before they finally died. And I think I can illustrate this best by putting up an overhead here. All right, I'm going to kind of set the stage for what was going on just before the fall of the northern kingdom. Now, this, of course, is Israel up here, and this is the southern kingdom of Judah down here. And the capital of Israel was the city of Samaria. And the capital of the southern kingdom of Judah was the city of Jerusalem. So you have Israel with its capital at Samaria. And its king is this fellow by the name of Pekah. He had finally assassinated all of the people that had been his competitors and taken over the throne there in the city of Samaria. Now down here in the south, of course, the kingdom is Judah, and the capital city is Jerusalem, and the king down there is this fellow Ahaz. Now, for a long time, the Israelites had fought against and been at war with the Syrians, or the Arameans, as they are more properly called, whose capital city was right over here at Damascus. Now, these are not to be confused with the Assyrians, starts with the letter A. That was the big superpower. They're too big to fit on this map. They lived way up to the north and occupied huge amounts of territory. They were looking down to these little kingdoms right here, thinking it would be nice to add these to our kingdom and to our empire. Now, we're not talking about those folks right now. We're talking about this kingdom of Syria or Aram. And I know it's real confusing that you have Syria and Assyria. But Syria or Aram was another small state, not much bigger than Israel and Judah, like these other small states like Ammon and Moab and Philistia and Phoenicia and so on. They were all just small countries. And it'd be kind of like, if you wanted to think about what they were and what Assyria was, the superpower, think about maybe the Central American states. Down South America where you've got Honduras and Nicaragua and so forth, these were small kingdoms. They were proportionately about that size, in some cases maybe even a little bit smaller. And yet up to the north of them was this huge superpower, like, say, the United States up to the north. And so all of these little states down here were afraid. And they used to fight among themselves. Israel and Judah used to fight. Syria and Israel would fight. They were always fighting. Ahab was killed in a battle between the Israelites and the Syrians a few years earlier. So they were usually fighting. But you know what little countries like that do when suddenly they are faced by a threat from a big power outside. They kind of want to band together. And specifically, it was Pekah, the king of Israel here, who sent up to Damascus up here, where a fellow by the name of Rezin was king. And this fellow Rezin and Pekah said, hey, look, let's form, we'd say in political terms today, they said, let's form a coalition. No one of us are big enough to hold off the Assyrians, and we know they're planning to come down here and try and take over all this territory. They said, no one of us is big enough to hold off the Assyrians. So what are we going to do? And so these two former enemies decided to get together. And they said, let's just band together. And if we get all these little states down here to band together, and maybe independently we might not be able to stand up to Assyria, but we put all of our strength together and maybe we'll be able to stop them. And of course, the Egyptians down here, they were saying, yeah, that's a good idea. The Egyptians would like nothing better than for all these little states to stand together, you know, and block the Assyrians. Because sooner or later, the Assyrians wanted to, and eventually did, come down and into the land of Egypt itself. But now, if this is going to succeed, they're going to need to get everybody to join. And most especially, they're going to need to get this kingdom of Judah down here, with its king, Ahaz, to join their anti-Assyrian coalition, if you will. Now, I'm summarizing a lot of stuff you can read about in 2 Kings chapters 14 and 15 and 16. But that was the plot. They were going to band together to stop the Assyrians. Well, they sent to Ahaz, do you want to join? And Ahaz, he didn't want to join. Now, Ahaz kind of looked at the situation, and he said, look, even if we all band together, we're not going to be able to stop Assyria. And so he didn't want any part of that. He said, this is a hopeless cause. And so he refused to join. Well, now you think about these fellows, Pekah and Rezin here. What are they going to do if Ahaz is not going to join their coalition? Well, their decision was that before they fought Assyria, the first thing they needed to do was join forces with each other to make war on Ahaz there. And so what they did is Rezin, the king of Damascus, or Syria there in Damascus, came down and joined up with Pekah here in Israel, and the two of them came down and laid siege to the city of Jerusalem. And they wanted to get rid of Ahaz. They wanted to attack the city of Jerusalem and assassinate King Ahaz and put somebody on the throne that would join their anti-Assyrian coalition. And so here's Ahaz sitting down here in Jerusalem, and he's under attack. He might have been able to deal with either one of these by itself, but he's under attack from two kingdoms that together about the same, you know, each one's about the same size he is. Together, they're more than twice his size. And so what's he going to do? Now, that's sort of the background for a passage I want everybody to turn to now. If you would, turn to the book of Isaiah and the 7th chapter. Because down here in the southern kingdom of Judah at this time, God had a prophet by the name of Isaiah. And we're going to read about what happened and what Ahaz did in this situation. It says in Isaiah chapter 7, starting in the first verse, says, now it came about in the days of Ahaz, son of Jotham, son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, the king of Aram, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but could not conquer it. They had laid siege to the city. Verse 2, it says, when it was reported to the house of David, that would be King Ahaz, he was the descendant of David, reigning on the throne at that time. When it was reported to the house of David, saying, the Arameans have encamped in Ephraim, his heart and the hearts of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake with the wind. So Ahaz is terrified. He hears that these Arameans, these Syrians under Rezin, have come down. They're in the tribal territory of Ephraim here. And they haven't come to attack the north. They've come to join with the northerners to attack him. And they're terrified. says their hearts were just shaking like the trees of the forest when the wind blows through and the leaves shake. Well, at this point, the Lord sends Isaiah. Now, you think about what if you were in, it's not a Bible class, so I won't ask you to actually respond, but try to think like a military person, I guess, here, a political strategist or something for a minute. If you were in Ahaz's shoes right here, and you found yourself under attack by these two kings that were stronger than you were, and the reason they're attacking you is because they want to assassinate you and put somebody else on the throne who will join their larger plan to make an anti-Assyrian coalition, what would you do? What would be the good political strategy right here? Well, he couldn't send to his near neighbor Egypt down here because the Egyptians, they'd be all in favor of these guys doing the fighting. You know, Egyptians are down there saying, y'all fight those Assyrians. We're right behind you. And they would stay right behind the whole time, too. But they certainly weren't going to help. So what would you do? Well, it's not too hard to understand what he did, what he was planning to do. What he was planning to do was send to Assyria and say to the Assyrians, he was just going to kind of make an end run around the whole thing. He's to say to them, look, these guys want to fight against you. He says, I don't want to fight against you. He says, if y'all come down here, I'll be your loyal subject. And so he says, how about you come help me? And so he sends to the Assyrians, and he says, you come attack these guys. And, of course, that would take the pressure off of him, and that would destroy their ability to resist the Assyrians, and it would put him in good with the Assyrians when they did get there. So that's what he was planning to do. But that wasn't what the Lord wanted him to do. Now, this comes to the real point of the lesson, I think, to learn from all of this tonight is to look through what happens. Lord sent Isaiah to him. What do you think the Lord wanted him to do? I mean, he's sitting there saying, now who do I join this coalition and try to stand against the Assyrians? Do I try to get help from Egypt? No, Egyptians are not interested in helping. Do I try to, kind of get one step ahead of everybody and go ahead and declare myself early as an ally of the Assyrians so that when they come, they may destroy everybody else, but they'll spare me? Or, and he's sitting there thinking, you know what the Lord wanted him to do? The Lord wanted him to do nothing. I mean, basically, politically. The Lord wanted him not to trust in Egypt, not to trust in his own military power, not to trust in an alliance with Israel or Aaron, and not to trust an alliance with Assyria. The Lord wanted him just to trust in the Lord. And the Lord sent his prophet Isaiah to him, basically to tell him that. And so in Isaiah chapter 7 here, then the Lord said to Isaiah, go out now to meet Ahaz, you and your son Shear-Yashub, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the Fuller's Field, and say to him, take care, be calm, and have no fear, and do not be faint-hearted because of these two stubs of smoldering firebrands on account of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram and the son of Rimlah. Because Aram and Ephraim and the son of Rimlah have planned evil against you, saying, let us go up to Judah and terrorize it and make for ourselves a breach in its walls and set up the son of Tobiel as a king in the midst of it. They had somebody they were planning to replace Ahaz with. Thus says the Lord God, it shall not stand, it shall not come to pass. And he says, within a set period of time, both of those kingdoms will be destroyed. And in verse 9, he says, the head of Ephraim is Samaria, the head of Samaria is the son of Remaliah. He says, if you will not believe, you surely will not last. And then he goes more. He says, now that's the word that the Lord has spoken. He says, don't worry about this. You don't have to appeal to Egypt. You don't have to appeal to Assyria. You don't have to trust your own armies. All you have to do is trust the Lord. And he says, and if you won't, if you don't trust the Lord, it's not going to work. But that's what you've got to do. You've got to believe that the Lord will protect you and take care of you in this. And then he went in one better. In verse 10, he said, the Lord spoke again to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God. Make it as deep as Sheol or as high as heaven. And what he's saying is, look, you know, I know I'm asking you really to do something tough. The armies are just outside the walls there, and they're stronger than you are. And you're tempted to try to make this alliance with Assyria, send to Assyria and try to make an alliance with them. And he says, what I'm telling you to do, I know it's tough. I'm telling you to sit tight and trust the Lord and let the Lord deliver you. And he says, and because it's a tough thing, you know, he says, you just ask, and the Lord will give you any type of sign. You ask for some miracle. You ask me to do some miracle, I'll do it. And the Lord will give you the miracle. He'll give you the sign so that you'll know that he's going to keep his word. Well, Ahaz declined. He said, no, he says, you know, sometimes people make us an offer and we don't want to accept because then we'll feel obligated. And he didn't want the miracle. He already knew what he wanted to do. One thing he knew he couldn't do in his mind was trust the Lord. Those were all pretty words that Isaiah was saying. But those armies sitting at his gates were real right there. And the thing he was just not able to do was trust the Lord. And yet that's exactly what the Lord told him to do. At the very moment when it looked the most difficult to trust the Lord, that's exactly when you most need to trust the Lord. The Lord even offered to give him a sign, a miraculous sign, to prove that the Lord would deliver him. And Ahaz said, if you follow up in the next verse right there, it's kind of a pretended piety. He says, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. He says, oh, I don't want to test the Lord. Well, the truth of the matter is he didn't want the sign. Because if he had a sign, then it'd make it all the harder for him to refuse to trust the Lord. And he already knew what he wanted to do. He wanted to appeal to Assyria. And so he refused. He refused. He appealed to Assyria. And you can read in 2 Kings chapter 16 where in fact he went up to, he invited the Assyrians to come. And the Assyrians were only too glad to get an invitation. They were probably going to come whether they got one or not. And they came down and pretty soon they had destroyed and captured the city of Damascus. And King Ahaz went up to meet them up there at Damascus and made a covenant with them, worshiped their gods, even brought an altar back and put it in the temple and removed the altar to Jehovah that belonged there in the temple. He sold out to Assyria to save his neck, what it called it, because he couldn't trust the Lord in a time of crisis. And he sold out not only himself personally, but he sold out his nation as well. And the Assyrians came, they destroyed the northern kingdom. They destroyed Syria and took the city of Damascus just a short while thereafter. They came down and took most of the land of Israel, and just a few years later they came and took the rest of the land of Israel. And in a sense, it looked like Ahaz might have saved his neck. I suspect a lot of political analysts looking back at this today say he made a good choice. But he failed to trust the Lord. And spiritually, he destroyed his own people by doing that. He destroyed himself by doing that. One thing the prophets kept saying over and over again was you need to trust the Lord. Don't trust Egypt. Don't trust Assyria. Don't trust your own strength. Trust the Lord. Look at a couple of examples. Look at the prophet Isaiah and the 30th chapter. Isaiah chapter 30. God says, woe to the rebellious children, declares the Lord, who execute a plan, but not mine. That's exactly what Ahaz had his plan. His plan for saving his neck and saving his nation. But it wasn't God's plan. God had told him what his plan was, and he didn't want to follow it. He says, they make an alliance, but not of my spirit. In this case, the prophet Isaiah was talking about an alliance that they tried to make with Egypt, who proceed down to Egypt without consulting me, to take refuge in the shadow of Pharaoh, and to seek shelter in the shadow of Egypt. And, of course, they had chosen Egypt over the Lord. Look at the prophet Hosea. Hosea prophesying up in the north during this very same time, where they were, again, trying to solve things, what seemed to them the hopeless situation, making some type of political alliance that would bail them out. Hosea chapter 7 and verse 11 says, "So Ephraim has become like a silly dove without sense. They call to Egypt. They go to Assyria. They try anybody that will come to help anybody but the Lord." And later on, Hosea tells them what they really need to do, how they need to repent. And in chapter 14 of Hosea, he says in verse 1, "Return, O Israel, to the Lord your God." And verse 2, he says, "Take words with you and return. Say to him, take away all iniquity and receive us graciously, that we may present the fruit of our lips. Assyria will not save us. We will not ride on horses, nor will we again say our God to the work of our hands." Don't think you're going to find salvation with Assyria, or salvation with Egypt, or salvation with your own armies, your own horses. It says your salvation is from the Lord. And that's exactly what Isaiah couldn't do. And I fear sometimes that's what happens to us. We are so fearful, so lacking in faith, we feel like, as it were, we have to take our salvation into our own hands. And we do that with all kinds of problems that we face in this life. And the word that the Lord spoke through the prophets was always, first and foremost, above all else, trust in the Lord. And sometimes that's the hardest thing to do. We kind of want to make that sort of an afterthought. I'm going to have all my proper insurance policies and everything. I'm going to have all my bases covered, and then I'm going to trust the Lord after that. But what he said is trust the Lord first. And so it is. Well, Ahaz's policy turned out to be a disaster. I want to go back to Isaiah chapter 7. And for just a moment, we bring the lesson to a conclusion. We sang a song right before we began lesson 9, "Tell Me the Story of Jesus." And I said, well, we're going to study the Old Testament, so we're not going to be studying about Jesus. But I would suggest that everything in the Bible is ultimately the story of Jesus. It may not always be immediately clear how that's so, but somehow everything back here in the Old Testament is leading up to the coming of Christ. And what happened back there in Isaiah chapter 7 was that Ahaz refused the sign that God said he was going to give. That God had offered him a chance, because Ahaz already knew what he wanted to do, and it wasn't God's plan, it was his plan. But that set the occasion for the prophet Isaiah to say to him, basically, look, you rejected the sign God offered you, now God's going to give you his own sign. But notice what a sign it is. In Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 14, let me begin actually in verse 13. Then he said, Isaiah, after Ahaz rejects the sign that God had offered him, Isaiah says to Ahaz, "Listen now, O house of David. Is it too slight a thing for you to try the patience of men that you will try the patience of my God as well? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with child, and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel." And he goes on to say some more things I'm not going to try to work through tonight or at the end of my time. But look, it is in this very situation that one of the most important prophecies about the coming of Christ is made, that he would be born in the house of David of a virgin. And, of course, that's the very passage that's quoted in the New Testament, Matthew chapter 1, in connection with the birth of Jesus, the birth of Jesus to a virgin. And here, you think about the very presentation of Jesus as the sign that God gives. that ultimately what we need to do is trust not in man, not in this kingdom or that kingdom or this choice or that choice or this political solution or any other thing. We need to trust the Lord and trust Him when it seems like there's no other way out. That's really the thing that the children of Israel found themselves unable to do. That's what led to the fall, first of the northern kingdom up there, and eventually the southern kingdom as well. Ahaz basically put his own southern kingdom on the same track that the northern kingdom was on. And it took a little bit longer for the south to fall, but eventually they did too. Eventually the Assyrians came to their land. Now, next Sunday night, or the next Sunday night that we have another lesson in this series, I'm going to talk about another king, a son of Ahaz, Hezekiah, who really reverses what his father did and trusts the Lord as much as his father failed to trust the Lord. But that's going to be another story. Now we're going to stand and sing our song of invitation in just a moment. I ask you to turn to the song that's been selected. You think about the fact that God has in fact given us a sign of the one born of a virgin, not only born of a virgin, but died on the cross for our sins and raised to walk in newness of life, that we might trust Him for our salvation. If you're subject to the invitation, you need to confess Jesus as Lord, to repent of your sins and be baptized for the remission of those sins. We extend that invitation now while we stand and sing together.